you, Dr. Roberts, for the introduction. I'm going to talk to you guys about one of the chapters of my dissertation at the University of Nebraska, focusing on iron redox chemistry in golf course putting green soils. So the soils that we're talking about are two-tiered sand-based putting greens. They feature a 30-centimeter layer of sand over a 10-centimeter layer of gravel. The sand is preferable because it drains very quickly after a large rainfall, but layering it over coarser textured gravel creates a zone of preferential water retention, like we heard about in the last talk, and this is a benefit for the plant roots to have more moisture in the root zone, but it also results in an area where we have persistently wet soil over persistently dry soil with that gravel. And it's at this interface of soil texture and this moisture gradient that we have layers forming. So the primary focus of my PhD research is looking at how iron oxide can cement sand and gravel particles together at the interface of sand and gravel in these systems and reduce infiltration, result in saturated soil conditions, and eventually anaerobic root zone conditions and a decline in turf quality. So we've seen these layers form in several locations across a broad range of geography with, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, Hawaii. We've seen it in the Pacific Northwest, the Northeast, and even internationally, Hong Kong, Vietnam, the UK, Sweden. But we don't exactly know how these layers are forming, and so that's where the need is for this research. These types of similar layers form in natural soils, and they're called plaquic horizons. They're dark reddish pan layers that are 1 to 25 millimeters thick. They're cemented by iron, and they sometimes contain manganese and organic matter. And it's well documented that these iron-cemented layers in natural soils form at boundaries of EH and pH. We're going to talk about those two things. What happens is iron 2 shifts to iron 3 in the redox reaction, and that is what causes this precipitate of iron to form. And so in a soil, we see an anoxic zone above and an anoxic zone below. So it's an area where iron accumulates at that boundary of redox potential. So Fe2 is reduced iron. We see it in poorly drained, wet, anaerobic soils, typically with a gray-blue color, and it has a greater solubility compared to Fe3, which is oxidized iron. We tend to see this in more oxygenated soils, has a reddish-orange color, and a lower solubility, so it's more likely to be in a solid form or a precipitate. So explaining whether the iron will be in iron 2 or iron 3, it all depends on two factors, EH and pH. So EH is also called redox potential. Basically, it's the tendency of an environment to donate or accept electrons. And so a positive EH indicates an oxidizing environment. A negative EH indicates a reducing environment. So if you think about soils, a wet, saturated, anaerobic type of soil would be more reducing, and then a well-oxygenated soil would be more oxidizing. And so just focused on the y-axis, EH, let's assume we have a given soil pH of, say, 7.5, where that yellow dot is. What happens if we shift EH? Well, as you see, as you go from a lower EH to a higher EH, we shift from iron 2 to iron 3. And that causes this redox reaction. Iron oxidizes, precipitates as a solid. So in that soil here, the anoxic region would likely have a low redox potential. The oxic region would likely have a higher redox potential. And so as the iron hits that shift in EH, it oxidizes or precipitates. Now, let's assume we have a given EH, let's say plus 0.4 volts. The units there are volts. So pH also independently affects the iron speciation. So if we go from a low pH to a high pH at a given EH, we also go from iron 2 to iron 3 due to that pH shift. And so we see that in turf soils where we have a low pH sand built on top of a high pH gravel. As the iron travels through that sand in a reduced form, and when it hits that high pH gravel, it shifts into the iron 3 species. So I did a little demonstration to show kind of how we can think about this in soils. I used a silica sand with a pH of 5.2, and then I put a layer of baking soda at where you see those blue lines, so at the surface, further down, and then the one on the right has no baking soda. Baking soda has a very high pH. So I added ferrous sulfate to the surface of each of these, and then I leached it through each of these containers. And then 24 hours later, look what happens. The iron only reacts when it reaches a high pH boundary. So all the way on the right, that got the same amount of iron as the other three columns, but the iron shot right through and drained and leached out of the soil. On the left, the baking soda was at the top, and the iron began to oxidize immediately and oxidized kind of homogeneously throughout that container. The next two, you can kind of see where that baking soda was layered. That's where the iron redox reaction began. So how does this relate to a putting green soil? Well, we can kind of take the same train of thought. On the left, we have an alkaline, high pH sand over a granite, low pH gravel. In the middle, we have a low pH sand over a low pH gravel, so there's no pH grade boundary there. And on the right, we have a low pH sand and a high pH gravel. Add ferrous sulfate to the surface of each of these, leach it through. 24 hours later, in the alkaline sand, you see that orange color. It looks like the iron has oxidized and precipitated, but it's homogeneous throughout this whole container. It's not forming a thin band that's, you know, cementing together in one thin location. It seems to be homogeneous. In the middle, there's not much evidence that the iron was ever there. It leached right through. On the right, the iron quickly traveled through the sand, but when it hit the limestone, the high pH gravel, it began to oxidize. So this just kind of demonstrates how pH can affect the iron redox reactions on a very short time scale. And this kind of was the background or our train of thought as we approached our replicated column study. So the objective of our column study was to determine how iron fertilization and root zone chemistry affect iron mobility. So on the column on the right, this was just kind of a preliminary demonstration. I added a 100x rate. It was 5,000 kilograms per hectare of iron sulfate, and then leached it through, and you can see an accumulation of iron just above the gravel layer. So our experimental design was a 3x2x2 factorial with three replications. We had a non-fertilized treatment and then two different rates of iron, a half pound and 1 pound per thousand for 25 and 50 kilograms per hectare. The iron was ferrous sulfate heptahydrate, so a 20% iron source. We had two different sand sources, a silica sand from Florida with a low pH, and then a calcareous sand from Wisconsin with a higher pH. And then we have two gravel sources, a granite rock from Minnesota with a low pH, and a limestone source from Nebraska with a high pH. So we have this 2x2 factorial of sand and gravel combinations, and then we, you know, replicate this three times, and we apply the non-fertilized and the two rates of iron across these root zone combinations. And so we started this study a few months ago, and something that we're really excited about is this approach that we're taking. We're using X-ray fluorescence, or XRF spectroscopy, to actually measure the iron concentration of the soil inside of a column. So we're actually measuring it through the wall of this tube. And this allows us to go in there, you know, between each application and measure the iron concentration. So you almost get a real-time view of how iron is moving and accumulating in the soil. So in this demonstration column where I added a 100x rate of iron in one shot, you can see the layer visually, and then we also are picking it up with the XRF. So we're really excited because this is something really unique to not only turf, but also to soil science in general. But we hit some challenges, or we ran into some challenges with this. We were doing this by hand, holding the XRF and scanning in one-inch increments. And it was taking over 24 hours to scan our 36 columns. And we're trying to scan once a week. This is just a not feasible amount of time. There's also radiation exposure as you're using the XRF. And then we are also seeing attenuation of the X-ray intensity, or like a decrease in the readings that we're getting through the tube wall. And so holding it by hand, there's a lot of user error. After 24 hours, you're getting really tired. So I should say the undergrads are getting really tired. I'm just kidding. But so there's too much variability and error. And so what we did was we stopped the study and we restarted it after we found a solution. And so I'm going to show you that solution. The UNL instrument shop constructed an automated or auto sampler stand for the XRF unit. So there's a mechanism, you can program it in Linux. It pushes the trigger of the XRF unit, it begins a scan, and then it can position those columns in any way you desire. So it has three different motors, one that rotates the columns, one that moves them left and right, one up and down. And then, for example, we might scan a given depth multiple times to get an average, and then we can program it to scan in 2-centimeter increments for all six columns. So you can program it, press start, go do your other stuff for 2 hours, come back, and the six columns are scanned very consistently. You know, little user error involved. So this was an albatross of a thing to undertake, and it took about a year to build this. So it was worth the wait, but it has slowed down the project for sure. But we're really excited because we did some preliminary work to just see how well we could track iron inside those tubes. So we created some standards of known soil iron concentration that we mixed into the soil, ranging from 0 to 200 grams per kilogram. And then we did, with the columns sitting still, we did 10 replicate scans around around that column. And we're able to track iron concentration in the soil with those XRF readings, as you can see on this graph. And the R-squared is pretty tight, 0.9853. But we took this a step further and actually figured out a way to program that XRF stand to do the scans while the column is rotating. So it presses the trigger, begins a slow rotation, and it's scanning while it's rotating, and it's getting an average of all the, that whole circumference of the column. And so the graph on the right, there are actually 10 data points within these clusters. It looks like one, but there's 10 in there. They're so tightly grouped. The R-squared is 0.9954. And so we're really excited about using this method. I think it's the first stand of its kind, and this will be the first study to document iron accumulating in real time with this type of methodology. So we're extremely excited about it. If you guys want to buy one of these, the instrument shop is willing to make more of them, but they said that it will be more expensive than it was for us because they didn't know what they were getting into. It sounded simple, but once they got into it, it was quite a bit more work than they thought, but the result was worth it. So at the end of all this, eventually we're going to have a mass balance. We'll know how much iron we added. We'll have these XRF readings to show how iron has been translocated. So we'll have iron by depth measurements over time, which is super exciting. And then we'll be able to look at transformations of iron, whether it's iron 2 or iron 3, by doing some speciation. And then we'll be able to measure the output of the system, so how much iron is in the leachate water, and then how much iron was assimilated into tissue as well. So this whole process of studying this issue, for me, I first observed it in 2008 during a summer internship in Hawaii. We first characterized it in 2014 with kind of an observational study. Now we are working on synthesizing the layer in the lab, and I'm hoping that we'll have those data by 2017. That will allow us to create a model and try to predict what is making these layers form. And from that, we can have, you know, two different outcomes. We can create recommendations to prevent these layers from forming, and then also get at, you know, remediating these layers. Is there anything we can do in the field to dissolve them or remediate them in the field once they've already formed? So with that, I'd like to acknowledge all of these people, and I'd love to take any questions. Dr. Burnt? Yes. Yep. The question was, were we ever able to measure redox potential at that interface? Yes, we are doing a side-by-side study that I didn't talk about in larger root frame boxes, and we have platinum electrodes installed into that. So we'll have those four soil combinations with one rate of iron, and then we'll measure the redox potential at different depths in those. So that will supplement the results from this replicated column study. It's very difficult to measure redox potential, though. So, yes. Question? Question was, have we looked at chelated iron? Do we expect it to behave similarly? I would expect chelated iron to remain soluble longer than a non-chelated, like ferrous sulfate. We had to pick and choose our treatments. The study, as currently designed, is about as much as it can handle. We're going to follow up with future research and look at chelated versus non-chelated iron to see if the chelate keeps it soluble longer. Question? Okay, thank you.